Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Psychology, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host with the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute. Today we'll be talking to Rabbi Naftali Rothenberg about his new book, Rabbi Akiva's Philosophy of Love. Rabbi Rothenberg is a senior research fellow at the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute. In addition to his many other achievements, he is the 2011 laureate of the Liebhaber Prize for the Encouragement of Religious Tolerance in Israel. Naftali Rothenberg, welcome to the show.
Welcome, shalom.
Naftali, I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up? What's been important in your intellectual development? Tell us about yourself.
Oh, this is the most embarrassing thing in our meeting today, because we can't jump simply to Rabbi Akiva Philosophy of Love. I assume that not. Okay, so I was born in Haifa and grew up in Jerusalem. In a few days, I will turn to be 70. So it was many years ago.
Happy birthday!
Thank you very much. You know, we are celebrating together now, and I studied in the Litvakish yeshiva in the ultra-Orthodox world, and later or parallel philosophy and Jewish thought in the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. I have a lot of mentors, and we have only a few minutes.
Then we'll move to the content.
Yes, in the last for the last 25 years, I engage with the Van Leer Jerusalem Institute. It is a very wonderful place, and I'm serving in the rabbinate for the last 45 years. Out of these 33 years, the rabbi of Har Adar, which is a suburb town to Jerusalem.
So how did you come to write about the philosophy of love?
Yes, this is a very good question, because, you know, studying in the Litvakish yeshiva, even when you read, text about love, you don't see the love in them, because you do only the analysis, you know, the dry, very dry analysis. But I lived 4 years in New York, and I was asked to give a lecture in New York. As you know, it's the world capitals for singles. I was asked to give lecture about love in Judaism to a group of 300 singles, men and women. And I had to prepare the lecture. And suddenly I discover, while preparing the lecture, that Judaism is all about love. So this was my beginning. I need to thank to my students in the Y of Upper East Side in New York, some 25, 30 years ago. And since then, I am studying everything about love in Judaism, love in the canonical literature, and comparing it to other cultures.
So tell us, and some people listening may not be familiar with who Rabbi Akiva was, when did he live, and most importantly, for this interview, what makes him the sage of love?
Okay, so Rabbi Akiva is the, I would say, the most important figure in all rabbinic literature since the Tanaic time to the 13th century. He lived between the 1st and the 2nd century, but I'm not dealing with Rabbi Akiva who lived where he lived during this time, because we don't have one sentence or one thing that he said that was written in his life. So the character, the image of Rabbi Akiva for me is it's a cultural phenomena in our libraries of Judaism throughout more than 1,000 years, that everything that he said is written. This, when I say he said, I'm not speaking historically, because we can't know what he said and something else. But it's Rabbi Akiva is the main, is the most important figure among the rabbis, is the main pillar of all this literature. If you are taking him out, you don't have Jewish culture at all, halachically and philosophically, etc., etc. And your next question was about what made him...
What makes him... Why do you call him the sage of love?
Okay, first of all, because this was... I think the main, but at least one of the main part of his studies. But if to summarize in few words, he appeared in a love story. He was ignorant till they, according to the legends. I'm speaking about Rabbi Akiva, the literature image. Again, I'm emphasizing this.
Yes.
So he appeared, he was discovered by the daughter of his master as an ignorant. She offered him to marry him, and in one condition, that he will go to study, because she thought that he has this potential to be Rabbi Akiva, because he wasn't Rabbi Akiva, he was simply Akiva, ignorant man that he didn't even know to read in this time when she approached him. And she made him to what he became. To what he became. Okay? Now...
Her love was transformative. She made him into someone who fulfilled his potential, and that was because of love.
Exactly. The largest and the main chapter in my book called From Her Love. Without the love of Rachel to Akiva, we couldn't have Rabbi Akiva in our tradition and culture. She created him. A woman created the biggest figure in Jewish culture. So this is one thing. Now let's go to the subject, in few words. He was the person that saved Song of Songs, the love song, from oblivion. He developed an entire philosophy, not only for philosophy, a practice, because he was a rabbi. He dealt with halacha, with the Jewish law. So entire philosophy and practice of marital harmony.
Now, just to clarify, the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon, it's sometimes called in English, is one of the books of the Bible, of the Tanakh, which is, on the surface, an erotic love poem between a woman and a man, and it's also a mystical poem of love between human and the divine.
Why you say that it's mystical between human and the divine? It's not written in. The name of God doesn't appear. Unlike, okay, this maybe you will, let's talk about it later, because I still want to show some of the fields of Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva developed entire philosophy and practice of marital harmony. He saw love between men and women as a sacred perfection of body. Body is very important. Mind and spirit. Without the body, you don't have the spirit. Without the body, you don't have the emotion and the mind and so on. So, and by the way, every us, we know that the Rabbi Akiva said that the main principle, the categorical imperative of Judaism is love your fellow as yourself. Ve'ahavta le'reacha kamocha, love your fellow as yourself. Again, this all the same person. And then he preached for principle for love for all who were created in God's image. And he also fulfilled the commandment to love God with every fiber of his being. And also when his soul was taken with him, which I called love to the last breath, when the Romans executed him and killed him. And he was the only one that entered to the Pardes, to the orchard of love, and came back safe because of his being the wisdom of love.
Well, let's take it bit by bit. When you mention when you talk about the Song of Songs in the book, you quote Rabbi Akiva as saying, "All of Scripture is holy, and the Song of Songs is the holy of holies." Now, on the surface, that seems like a very radical statement, but I'm sure you can explain it to us.
No, it is a radical, because, you know, usually most people, they look at things in the economy. They think that spiritual has nothing to do with the body, and the body is something low, and so on and so on. This wasn't the approach of Rabbi Akiva, and by the way, the main approach of the Jewish sages. Yes. So, right. So for but on the other hand, for him, the love, also the physical relations has to be together with emotion and with mind, not only with the physical. The physical itself, it's not love, but also the mind itself, or what people call spiritual, it's not love. So this is the thing that he said, love, harmonic love, needs to be in the whole, is and needs to be in the holy of holiest. Yes? It's not something it doesn't see the material, something that it's out of the religious life and spiritual life. I don't know if I answer well on this question.
Well, it's a complicated insight, since many religious traditions recommend a life of celibacy and withdrawal from family life as avenues of spiritual growth.
And this is
Judaism does not, and actually Islam don't either. And that is what you is that getting close to what you mean by harmonious love? Maybe you can explain that for us. What is harmonious about love?
The harmonious love uses the mind, feelings, yes, mm-hmm. and body, and you need to achieve in every. In every appearance of love, could be not only love between men and women, love between fellows, love of the wisdom, love of God, in everything, the involvement and the balance between the three needs to be there. Unlike the, as you said before, many religions that they see the body or the material not part of the of the worship, not part of the of the right way, and so on and so on. You know, to exclude the body, it's not right, according to our sages, and mainly according to Rabbi Akiva.
Yes, you write as well the following statement: the insight that love between man and woman is the source of wisdom and conjugal love stands on the highest plane of holiness, are the cornerstones of the moral life. So can you sort of unpack that statement? You've explained the emotional and the mental and the physical. How does that get to the cornerstone of the moral life?
Okay, first of all, I want to say that this idea that moral life begins with the most intimate relations that we have between the most close people to us, people that we love, people that we like our spouse, our children, something very, and of course, you know, this relation between men and women that we speak about, the Kabbalistic idea of tikkun olam, repair the world, doesn't begin, with all due respect, from going to countries far away and to help them. It begins with the relations, with the intimate relations. Couplehood, living together with the most close people that we live together, it's everyday test for relations, for moral relations. So how to speak to each other, not harm to each other. So everything can happen for good or not within this intimate world. So this is the idea. You know, there is a lot of people that preach morality to all over the world, but their family or their relation with their spouse, it's terrible. So what have done? This is the unit that we need to begin, the idea of tikkun olam. This is because, by the way, speaking of olam is the word, every human being, it's the entire world. And according to Rabbi Akiva and later sources, the complete world is the unity between the lovers. Again, the lovers can be a human being with his love to God, a human being, I mean, the couples between themselves, the love to wisdom, the love to your fellow, and so on and so on.
So that expression...
Do you feel that I answered your question? I'm not sure.
Absolutely.
Ah, yes. Very okay, well. Thank you very much.
I thought this was a very important point, one of many important points in your book. When you mention that tikkun olam, which is generally translated as repairing the world and is widely used to refer to social justice, that it means something else, both in the Talmud and in Kabbalah, that it has nothing to do with broken and repair. So say a little more about that.
Refer exactly to what you said. It's why we think that social justice can be implemented only by going to the poor neighborhoods. Of course, it is committed of everyone to help to the weak people, to poor people, to help to every human being. It's this, which is the foundation of social justice, This is, of course, I'm not against it, but why there is no social justice in our intimate life? Yes? You know, I don't have to tell you and the listeners how many tragedies, countless tragedies that we have in the framework of a family, you know? So sometimes I ask myself, okay, it's nice to be an activist for social justice, you know, in general, and to help and to do operations, and I'm for it. I'm taking part of it. But first of all, let's emphasize on the unit that we control everything in it, in the intimate unit between us and our close fellow, spouse, between children, between brothers, and so on and so on, in the intimacy. Let's do it in the intimacy, and then, or parallel to it, go to repair all the world and to do social justice in all the neighborhoods and so on and so on.
But of course, as Shakespeare said, the course of true love never did run smooth. And you write about how Rabbi Akiva looked at the role of obstacles, challenges, temptations in the philosophy of love. Can you speak to that issue?
Yes, well, it's a very broad issue, actually.
Take your time.
It's not because it's actually different fields and subjects. So I might give now one or two examples, and then you will continue to ask me and lead me to the right to the right direction in this. So something that is very interesting us when we speak about a person that we consider a sage of love and has an entire philosophy and developed religious laws, halakha, on the relations of love between the couple and between human people at large. So it's interesting how he behaves. Yes, and I'm of course aware of the fiction that was written about Rabbi Akiva in these relations, but this is fiction. I'm not dealing here with fiction, but I'm aware of it, and I appreciate it because I know. So, for example, the rabbinic literature, the Talmuds and the Midrashim tell us about the experience of Rabbi Akiva and the challenge of temptation to other women. He came to Rome. So they host him like Romans know. They send him to very, very beautiful prostitutes to spend the night with them. So what Rabbi Akiva will do, etc., etc. There is a long story about this. There is another story that Rabbi Akiva was, not only Rabbi Akiva, many rabbis used to say to people who were considered to be sinners that, while you are sinners, it's so simple to be a righteous, why you are a sinner. So there is kind of a test that God sent to them, and Rabbi Akiva sees a beautiful woman stand up on a palm tree, and he forgot that he is the great Rabbi Akiva, and he begin to climb the palm tree to achieve this woman. And there is also a story about the wife of the governor, the Roman governor in the Holy Land that came to seduce Rabbi Akiva. All this story ends like that Rabbi Akiva wasn't seduced, but he was aware of the beauty. Maybe he was seduced only in the test with the palm tree, but he was aware. Because it teach us, okay, if that the person who speak about harmonic love still have all the temptations, and it's the fact that you believe in idea in the everyday world, you have all these kind of challenges and tests and so on. So this is one way of example. But on the other way, Rabbi Akiva is dealing with the everyday challenges that, again, to speak about harmony and balance between body and spirit and mind, it's, you know, I can write books, everybody can speak about it. But in everyday life of a couple, to keep this harmony, you know, in the routine, in the challenges. And so he sometimes he was very, very, I would say, I don't have the English word for it, but anyway, he dealt practically and halachically with the harmony between the couple. And he ruled against most of the rabbis on this subject because for him to keep the harmony was so important. And also on another issues of, for example, a relation between people, you know, love your fellow. On this issue also, a lot of rulings of laws that he was different from others because he know that there are challenges, it's not easy. And of course, other experience, suffering in life, suffering. How you can love God when you suffer so much? Okay? And so on. And all this kind of way of looking at reality. He tried to teach his disciples how to look, how to analyze reality and to look different on the reality, which is not easy. This was his, according in the legend time, he lived 120 years. So we had a lot of time with the students to teach them how to deal with, and the time was very hard, you know, with the Romans and everything. So that they have everyday challenges, and they could teach them in reality and not only from books.
Well, and since his background was one of poverty and illiteracy, until, according to tradition, until he was 40, so he lived a life of struggle and difficulty, that perhaps made him more sensitive to those factors, how hard life can be, than some more privileged members of the scholars and sages.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, you talk about that he came to his strongest insight about love your fellow or love your neighbor as yourself.
Not love your neighbor. The word like neighbor doesn't exist. I know that this is the common. Yeah. Let's speak a little bit, if I may. May I?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So let's speak about a little bit about translation that changed the whole meaning. Okay. The word neighbor doesn't appear in Hebrew Bible. Doesn't appear. So every translator, love your fellow, love your neighbor as yourself, it's change of meaning. And I'll give you another thing that related to love. In Genesis, when the scriptures tell us about the creation of the world, and during the creation of the world, the creation of the human beings. So they use the in Hebrew they use the word, and God said, "Let's create Adam." Adam. It's not the name of a man. Now, in every, almost, I think that every translation of Genesis from Hebrew to English or to maybe other languages, instead of Adam, they take the name Adam, and they, you know what word they put?
Adam.
No, they don't say Adam. In my book, it's Adam when I quote.
Right.
But I don't use the translations. This is the... They said, and God said, let's create man in our right. image. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, now this is against all the meaning of the Bible, because later say, and let's create man, and God created the man and the woman. So he said, let's create man, and created man and woman. I speak about Genesis first. In Genesis 5, it said, let's create, this is the story of the creation of Adam, and then in the English Bible, creation of man. And then he said, and God created in his image man and woman, and called them Adam in the day he created them. Adam is the common name of man and woman after the creation. God created man and woman alike. This is simply what's written in the Hebrew Bible that was translated wrong in all Bibles. By the way, even Jewish translations use man, but it's not true. We have Ish in Hebrew, it's man. We have Isha, it's a woman. And together, only when they are together, when they are unite, it's Adam. Okay?
So it ought to be translated.
I don't want to offend everyone that calls his son, a masculine son, Adam, but it's
Well, that's an important clarification. Thank you. Thank you for explaining.
And it's very simple. It's very simple, believe me. So what was the question? Excuse me.
We were talking about difficulties, and you mentioned tragedies, suffering, which made me think of what you describe as Rabbi Akiva coming to his insight about love your fellow as yourself, particularly following the tragic death of thousands of his students. Tell us about that.
About what?
About what caused the epidemic or the plague?
About the death. So let's speak about the fact that Rabbi Akiva has said that the great rule, you see, the categorical imperative of the Torah is love your fellow as yourself. Now there is two possibilities. One possibility is educational failures, because as the Talmud tells us that the students died in epidemia. And the reason it was a punishment because they didn't respect each other. The relation, there was some wrong in the relations of the thousands of students of Akiva, and they all died in between Passover and Shavuot.
We'll go with Shavuot.
Yes, okay. So yeah. They all died in this period, in one period. This was written in Talmud, so it could be that it was a failure, educational failure of the great rabbi within the relation to his students. And then Rabbi Akiva, he do everything. He is beginning everything again and create students. And now maybe he emphasize more or found a way to educate them more in accordance to the rule of love your fellow as yourself. This is one possibility. The other possibility, as you said before, that he developed these ideas only after what he saw that happened with the relation of his students, because I assume that if someone has more than 20,000 students, yes, is not, in relation of them in everyday relations. He give the general the general teachings, but he's not educating them. And later he chose very, very special figures and made them to his students, big rabbis, and all. And these people, these five disciples, continue the tradition and the study, the rabbinic study, for generations after him. So this is the two possibilities that we can interpret it. And I don't have a personal opinion what is right, if it's a failure or it is a conclusion.
How do you reconcile the view of Rabbi Akiva as a religious leader committed to the foundational importance of harmonious love in every aspect of life with his role as a political activist, specifically someone who supported what turned out to be a catastrophic rebellion, the Bar Kokhba rebellion? How do you reconcile that in the personality of Rabbi Akiva?
Actually, I don't have to reconcile, because I think that 90%, now I'm not an historian, but I am aware and study history, and 90% was written by historians about the relations and the spatial relations of Rabbi Akiva and Bar Kokhba or Bar Kokhziva. Mm-hmm. Bar Kokhba, it's two things. It's a name that we know from Christian sources, late Christian sources, not Jewish. Yes, even not.
Yeah.
This is one thing. Second thing, it's a name that was adapted and developed in the modern national movement, in the Zionist movement, because, you know, the Zionist looks not for great scholars and rabbis, they looks for heroes. So they spoke a lot about the Maccabim, the Judah, the Maccabi, and others, and they develop all the legends around Bar Kokhba or Bar Kokhziva that became in our early education to be Bar Kokhba. So now back to Rabbi Akiva, but first we have to understand what happened. You said that the rebellion was a failure. All three big rebellions against the Romans were failures.
Right.
By the way, all the rebellions against the Syrian, or what we call in our tradition the Greek, regime of the Maccabim, also was a failure. It was successful for some times, but later on it was a failure. All the Jewish history, speaking of rebellions and fights, it was a history of failures. Okay,
I was trying to get to the psychological.
No, I understand. But let's go to psychological with the fact. But now, with the fact, but now let's do one fact more. Bar Kokhba was successful to create an army of almost 500,000 people. It says that almost every family in the Jewish people then, in Israel then, joined his army. So, and by the way, he has a very, very terrible relations with the rabbis. But few of the rabbis looked at him, especially in the 3 years that it was successful and he ruled part of Judea, and said maybe he is the Messiah. In the Jewish tradition, Rabbi Akiva was one of the rabbis, and probably many others. They thought maybe he will save us. It's not Rabbi Akiva wasn't the leader of this rebellion. There is no one source that prove us that he was involved in this rebellion. The only revolt of Rabbi Akiva was that he was gathering people and teach them Torah. This was the only thing that he did, and he was dying for this. Yes, they killed him for this reason, not for nothing to do with Bar Kokhba and so on. So there is not much to explain about it, because the facts are not the facts that were in some, you know, op-eds in the media.
You refer to the mystical story of the four sages who entered the esoteric orchard, the Orchard of Love, as you called it a little earlier, and one, all but Rabbi Akiva had bad outcomes. He alone emerged unscathed. What is the meaning of that story?
Oh, we have libraries who are trying to explain us the meaning of this story.
Well, as you bring it down in your book.
Okay, look, in our tradition, it's mean that people are, you know, there is many approaches to the story. People can speak about a real, you know, a real place, which is the Pardes, the orchards, and so on and so on. And people can speak about a journey in mind, a psychological journey, but not only of a feeling, but also of mind, of knowledge, and so on. People achieve the level of understanding the whole creation, understanding God, understanding all the spiritual layers of the divine, and so on. Can understand it in this way, all the secrets of the Torah, and so on and so on. To summarize in few words, what was Rabbi Akiva summarized? What was the difference between him and the three other great sages that entered to the orchard and failed? And he said, it's not that I am greater in knowledge of the Torah. It's not that I am greater from they are, but your deeds will draw you near and your deeds will distance you, which brings us back to the moral impact. What Rabbi Akiva said, that your behavior, if you behave morally, you will enter safe and withdraw safe from the orchard. If not, you can be the greatest of the greatest and to know almost everything, it's not going to help you. So we are going back to the moral foundation. This was the most important to Rabbi Akiva. The moral behavior is the condition for everything.
Well, that's a very good point to end up. We've taken a lot of your time. But before you go, tell us what you're working on now.
Okay, actually, I'm working now about a bestseller that was published in Italy in 1535. It's a book that called in Italian Dialoghi d'amore, Dialogue about Love, written by a Jewish sage, Yehuda Abarbanel, that wrote the book and died. And after he died, the book was published not by Jewish people. In all European languages, it became the most printed book in that time. 12 editions in Italian, 2 in Latin, 6 in Spanish, 6 in French, later on in German, and so on and so on. And influence the life of love and the literature of love and romantic literature from UK to St. Petersburg and all between, all Europe, because it's brought the ideas of harmonic love that we just spoke about them by this Jewish sage, Yehuda Abravanel, to the European Christian culture. So what I'm doing already 5 years, and I have at least 8-10 years to go, to read all this European literature that was written from the 16th to the beginning of the 20th century, you know, novels, poetry, thought, and so on, that was influenced by Dialoghi di Amore, by the book.
Wow, that sounds like a fantastic project.
It's a very enjoyable project. Thinks about the places and the libraries that I need to be there.
Right. Well, I will look forward to reading it eventually when it comes out, and trust that you will totally enjoy doing the research on it.
Thank
you very much for being on the show today. And thanks as well to our researcher, Bela Pasikoff.
Thank you very much.